Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, we're kicking off 2020 with an action-packed thriller. In a world of predators, it's a zero-sum game. You win or you die. For Pike Logan, dying is not an option. And my guest is Brad Taylor. He's Lieutenant Colonel retired, 21-year veteran of the U.S. Army Infantry and Special Forces, including 8 years with the 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment, popularly known as Delta Force. Taylor retired in 2010 after serving more than two decades and participating in Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraq Freedom, as well as classified operations around the globe. His final military post was as Assistant Professor of Military Science at the Citadel, which, interestingly enough, is where and how he started writing. He became an author. Brad has written 13 New York Times bestsellers. When not writing, he still serves as security consultant on asymmetric threats for various agencies. All sounds very mysterious there, doesn't it? Well, I have to apologize for my voice. I know it's very croaky, but we'd scheduled this interview 2.5 months ago, and I didn't want to have to cancel and rebook it. So here's our conversation. Brad Taylor is my guest. His new book, Hunter Killer. You spent 21 years in the military, and readers have said over and over that they can really tell your hands-on experience comes through those pages to them. And that's what differentiates your work from many other thriller writers out there today. So, interesting story about how you came to write the Pike Logan series. You said that he'd been in your head for a long time, and just tell us a little bit about how he came to you when you very first started writing.
Yeah, I've always been a voracious reader. I'm the kid that the mom came upstairs and said, turn the flashlight out and time to go to bed. And I just had in my head that I was going to write a book sooner or later. And I left a special mission unit at Fort Bragg, came down here to the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina to teach, and had a lot of time on my hands. I mean, it was a completely different world. It was like stepping off a bullet train and walking. I mean, I had a ton of time. And so I decided I'm going to write a book. And I wanted to write a story of redemption. I didn't set out to write a military thriller. But, you know, you do the Google search, and everybody says, write what you know, write what you know. And I was a Special Forces guy, so Pike became a counterterrorist commando. But that wasn't the genesis. I didn't set out to write a military thriller. I set out to write a story of redemption. If I'd have been a police officer, Pike would have been a cop.
Right.
Might have been a priest, Jennifer would have been a nun.
Right.
That's how it started.
Yeah, I love that you say you started this while your wife had gone out with girlfriends, and you said when she returned, I have good news and bad news. The good news is I can write. The bad news is it took me 3 hours to get out one paragraph.
Yeah, because I kept rewriting and rewriting and rewriting it. Then I realized that, you know, hey, just start writing. Get a few pages out, then go back and look at it. You don't have to worry about every sentence.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you still do that, because a lot of writers will just, you know, rush through a first draft and then go back and piece it together. Others prefer to stick with it.
What I'll do is I'll rush through a segment of the book. And when I say segment, I wish I could be more granular about it, but sometimes it's 5 pages, sometimes it's 100 pages. Depending on what's in my head. And then before I get to the next, there's a pause, just a mental pause in my own head. Before I get to the next section, I need to regroup and think about what I'm going to do. I'll go back and reread that and go back and fix it over and over again. And then when I'm ready to write again, I go back at it.
Mm. So let's share a synopsis of this book, Hunter Killer, with our listeners. I know that you've had 13 New York Times bestsellers, Brad, but I'm not sure how many of those were Pike Logan books.
They all were. Every
they
single
all
one.
Were.
No one's more surprised than me. I wrote the first one and it sold, and then every one since.
And so let's just share a synopsis of this story. It begins when one of his friends is killed in Charleston, South Carolina, in an explosion. and Pike Logan tracks those folks to Brazil, and just share some of the storyline with us.
Yeah, actually the storyline came out of, I wrote Daughter of War, my previous book, and there was an ancillary antagonist in that book that's called Wagner, which is a Russian private military company. It's a true organization. They're in Syria, they're in Libya, they're in Central African Republic. And I was doing research for this book, not even sure where I was going to go with it. And every morning I get feeds from all over the world about, you know, what's going on in the world, because I still do some security consulting, so I try to keep on top of stuff. And I had some tags for Wagner, and one of the tags came up that said that they were in Venezuela helping Maduro during his trials last year. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I started doing research on, you know, Russian strategy and that kind of thing. And I fell headlong into the absolute clown fest that was the Brazil elections last year.
Right, right.
And so I started looking at, they had the Lulu oil fields and the car wash scandal, and the Russians are definitely down there. And I thought, that's a story right there. And so that's kind of what generated the initial plot line. And what causes the crisis is the Wagner guys that are down there recognize Pike's team from Daughter of War, but Pike doesn't even know the Russians are down there. So the Russians think that they're down there for them when Pike doesn't even realize they're there. And it causes a lot of different things that happen that Pike's now got to solve.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about Pike Logan, because he's a very complex character, very interesting character. You write in the acknowledgements, you shared that there are two types of men. Maybe it was a blog post I read. You say there are killers and sons of killers. Pike Logan is the first. You are not. So explain what you mean by that.
Well, that's actually, there's an old saying in the Ranger Battalion that's, I'm not the killer man, I'm the killer man's son, but I'll do the killing till the killer man comes. And Pike is the killer man. And it was very hard to get to the level of special operations that I attained. Make no mistake, it was a hard, hard life. But to explain to a civilian, there's probably 1% on the planet that could play on the PGA Tour. Now, on the PGA Tour, there's somebody who's 100th on the money list, and nobody in America's ever heard of him. And then there's Tiger Woods. Well, I'm 100th on the money list, and I'm playing on the tour, but right. I'm not Tiger Woods, and Pike Logan is Tiger Woods.
Right, right. To get to that level, you said it's not easy. So there always is personal sacrifice when we get to...
Yeah.
We want to attain a certain level, and we have that commitment to go after it. What was the personal cost to you?
Well, it's super, super hard to serve at that level. We had a saying, my personal motto, I've never worked so hard to be average in my entire life. So it's just really difficult to get to that level. Every day, we actually had a saying, every day is another day of selection. So you go through selection, an official organization where they're officially selecting you, but every day you woke up was another day of selection. It's another day to get fired for not doing the right thing. So it's literally the tip of the spear.
Right, right. And Pike Logan, for you to have 13 New York Times bestsellers with him, he has to be a character that people really like and want to follow. So how do you keep his growth coming in each story?
That's actually the hardest thing. You hit the nail on the head. So it's not, and they call them Pike Logan thrillers, but in my mind, they're Pike and Jennifer thrillers. Jennifer Cahill's been there from the very get-go, and both of them have to grow. In the human condition, every day, you have a kid, you have, whatever happens in your life, you're changing, you're growing. And that is one of the hardest things to do, is when Pike first started out, when I was mentioning the story of redemption in One Rough Man, he's got a broken moral compass, he has no... his joy of life is completely gone. He doesn't want to do anything. And Jennifer Cahill starts out, he's completely amoral. Jennifer Cahill is more black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And they've both grown. So Jennifer's become more gray and Pike's become more black and white. He's got his moral compass back. But you do have to have growth through every novel. Something new has got to occur that shows some growth in the characters. Otherwise, you're just rewriting the last book.
Right. Well, with your background, you have a wealth of material there to pull from. You say all of the weaponry and the technology is real, but you do take creative license with it, as you are entitled to as a fiction writer. So give us an example of something in this book, Hunter Killer, that you took a little creative license with.
Well, there's a lot of things, and it's, when I say creative license, it's more along the lines of creative license as to whether the United States government's actually doing this stuff. If it's in the book, it can happen. For instance, I hacked the Alexa device. There's a hotel in Charleston that uses Alexa device as a Google, you know, assistant, and they're very easy to hack. And all of the devices, when they get on the same Wi-Fi network, because you're putting them in your home, they all work together. So if you have one in your bedroom, it does the same thing the one in the kitchen does. Well, you put all those devices inside a hotel room, that's individual rooms all the way around the hotel, but those devices are still talking to each other. So if you can get into a hotel room that has an Alexa, you can hack that Alexa and get the other one to turn on and start recording.
Yeah.
Now, does the government actually do that? I don't know. I do know the criminals do, and so I put it in the book.
It's not very comforting, I don't think, but there you go.
I don't have one of those devices in my house for that very reason.
No, I don't either.
My phone's spying on me all the time.
Yeah, yeah, I don't. I'm right there with you on that. I love that you are fully committed to the craft of writing. You take this, it seems, as seriously as you take, as you took your military career. And I read that you create a little leather-bound notebook for each book. So tell us about your process and how things start off for you.
Yeah, what generally happens is I'll write what I call a framework. My publisher said I need an outline. I said I don't even know how to do an outline. Because you get your entire life to write your first book.
You know? Right, right.
You finish your first book, and they're like, okay, give me the outline for the second book. I'm like, I didn't do an outline for the first book. I don't know how to do this. And so I create what I call a framework, which is basically I'll understand the threat vector, I'll understand the setting, but I won't really understand a whole lot in between A to Z. I just know the story arc. And I would say up until book 8, I would say I knew the ending. After book 8, I'd say 80% of the time I know the ending, and 20% of the time I'm going to end up changing the ending, and I end up just kind of trusting myself. But I carry around this little journal my wife bought me. It's a leather thing. It looks really cool. And I just jot it all the time. It's with me. It's like my Whoopi. I mean, if
right.
I'm leaving the house, that thing is with me. And if I'm sitting on a bus or if I'm waiting on something to happen, I'll break that thing open and start jotting down notes. And sometimes they're full-on pages of notes. Sometimes it's just bullet points. There is no real style or substance. I don't have a writing room. I don't have a writing desk. It's all free flow, really. I have a MacBook Air comes with me wherever I'm going, and I just start writing.
Yeah, very good. And so let's talk about characters and how you craft your characters, because if you don't have believable characters, you definitely would not have had 13 New York Times bestsellers there. But a lot of people steal, you know, bits of a person. They pour bits of themselves into characters. How does that work for you generally?
I think it happens organically. I don't ever look at somebody and say, I'm going to put that guy in a book, you know what I mean? Like, ooh, I like how that guy looks, I'm going to put him in a book. But you can't help but, you know, I am a human being, you can't help but infuse the characters. Like, Pike Logan's definitely got some of my smartassness in him. There's no doubt when I'm making a joke in the book that it's because I think it's funny. You know?
Right, right.
I'm trying to channel Pike Logan. But the characters are, in fact, without a doubt, you hit the nail on the head. That's the most important thing. If a bomb's going to go off in a parking lot and nobody's there, who cares? The only reason you care is because the bomb's going to go off in a car and there's two people in that car.
Right, right.
And if you don't like the characters that are in that car, you don't care either.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to make the reader care about it. I've never taken any writing instruction. My instruction has always been reading. And so when I go through my drafts and I'm reading it, I hit to a point, and I don't even know, sometimes I don't know why, but I'll hit a point and say, I don't like this. And it's not because of the syntax or the grammatical, you know, structure. It's because I don't like what I just wrote. And then I have to take a step back and go, why don't you like that? As a reader, if I don't like it, that means another reader's not going to like it. And I'm trying to capture a certain visceral feel, and if I'm not getting it, the reader's not going to get it. And so sometimes it takes a while to sit there and just try to sort that out.
Right. Do you have a favorite type of scene that you like to write, Brad?
I do. The action scenes, obviously, but the action scenes are always tied into the characters. So it's, I guess my favorite type of scene would be, which is probably going to be, let me think. Yeah, there's probably one in every single book, which I guess you could call the generic rescue scene.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not always a rescue. There's something else going on, but there is a point in time where somebody is just about to meet the maker, and somebody else stops it.
Mm-hmm. That makes perfect sense, given your background, right?
Yeah. So there's a few in Hunter Killer. So, I mean, I can think of three off the top of my head. So, in Daughter of War, there's one of my favorite scenes I've ever written is a 14-year-old Syrian refugee who's about to get whacked, and Pike saves her.
Right. And is there a particular point in the book or particular things about writing that you really struggle with?
Yeah, I tell you, the hardest thing is, because it is a series, that I have to, but all the books stand alone. You can pick up any of my books and read them. You don't have to know what happened in the previous books. They all stand alone. And to make sure they stand alone, I have to give enough background information about who Pike is, who Jennifer is, who the task force is, who the oversight council is, all that kind of stuff. Which in the first book, you kind of just flesh out as you're going along because you're creating the universe. Well, now I have to put a little rubber stamp about the universe in every book so people understand it. But I have to do it in such a way that it's not, let's take a break now, and I'm going to give you a PowerPoint presentation on the other books.
Right.
It's got to flow into the book. And that is really hard to do, especially at book 14. It's just like, I'm doing book 15 right now. It's like, oh, I got to introduce these guys. How do I do that? Which I haven't done before.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to cut and paste in the last book. And it's got to be a seamless bleeding in of information. So it's not just, chapter 2 is going to be the background all you people didn't get before. Now we'll start chapter 3. You've got to thread it in there. And that's probably the one thing that I really just like, God, I really don't want to do this again.
Yeah, and I have to say as a reader that I really appreciate when authors do that well, because there are several authors that I've read a lot of their books of with the same characters, and but I've also read books where, as you said, it sounds like somebody's inserted a PowerPoint into the middle of the book.
Right. Let me stop because you people haven't read this book before and give you some background.
Right.
It's hard to do that with. Well, I mean, it's not hard to do it. It's just, it's tedious for me. That's probably the worst part about it. I want to get to the meat of the book. Okay, we got the background. Let's get to the meat of the book.
Right. Yeah, because you already know all this, so you want to just get on with it. So
you have to do it in such a way that the previous readers, you don't want to get so much information they're skipping pages, but you want to get so little information that new readers don't understand what's going on.
Yes, absolutely. So I wanted to ask you about a blog post that you posted January 2nd about Iran and how U.S. sanctions are working, but we need to go after leadership. And you said
I posted yesterday.
Yesterday. And you said in the blog post, I don't mean assassination, and yet that's exactly what we woke up to this morning. What are your views on that?
I have quite a few views, to be honest with you. First of all, targeted killing, actually, my master's thesis, believe it or not, in irregular warfare is counter-leadership targeting and conflict termination. So I have a 200-page thesis on this very thing. But it's not assassination in the sense that assassination is for a political goal. So if you were going to do a tank-on-tank battle and you said, hey, my tank, kill any tank that's got antennas because those are the commanders. That's not assassination. You're just trying to win the battle.
Mm-hmm.
If you are, in fact, killing somebody to effect political change, then that would be assassination. If Soleimani is trying to do, and I don't know, I don't have the intelligence, but if he was literally going to attack a bunch of Americans and we're doing a preemptive assault against him to prevent that, then that's not assassination. I personally am not sure that we actually meant to kill him, to be honest with you. I think that we were tracking Mahdi, who's the head of the Hezbollah Iraqi militia, the people that had rocketed our bases and stormed the embassy and all that. And I think we had some threat vectors that were saying he was going to attack us, and we started tracking him. And we said we don't want to kill him in a city where there's collateral damage. We want to kill any kids. And then we saw him in the middle of the airfield and said, hey, he's wide open. Let's hit him. And then they said, who else was in that car? Which then became the story. Now, I don't have any proof of that whatsoever. But just the delay in the Pentagon response and the very incredible escalation that would be, I was just, as soon as I heard it, I was like, wait a minute. So they shoot a drone down, we don't do anything. They mine the ships, we don't do anything. They knock out 5% of the global oil supply with cruise missiles, we don't do anything. They protest our embassy, so we kill the number one general in Iran. just didn't make a lot of sense to me. So I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but...
Well, I found it interesting reading your blog post. I'm not... I try to stay away from politics these days. I just got to a point where it's like I have too much...
And actually, speaking of that blog post, so I post that blog post, which is no politics in it, just national security affairs. Here's what we need to do.
Yes, yes, very much.
Immediately, all the comments I get back on Facebook and Twitter are, you know, Obama screwed this up and Trump's a hero. And I'm like, what?
No, your post was very matter of fact. It was very matter of fact. It was not political at all. But I did find it interesting reading through there, and I think people who read your books would find it interesting too. A question about why you chose to write in the first person in this series.
That is actually, I've been asked a lot of times how do I know to break the rules and go first and third in a book.
Mm.
And the truth of the matter is, I didn't know it was a rule. I've never had any instruction in writing, and Nelson DeMille, one of my favorite books is Plum Island with John Corey. Nelson DeMille's done it, Joseph Fender's done it, a bunch of writers have done it. And I wrote the entire first book in third person, and I just didn't like it. And so I went back, and any time Pike was in the room, I changed it to first person.
Right.
I didn't know that at the time was some kind of horrendous thing you're not supposed to do. And then it sold, and I've been doing it ever since. So I guess the answer is I didn't know any better. I just liked the way I read.
I think it makes it more immediate myself, but...
Well, that's what I was looking for, yeah, because you can't do it third person, but you can with the first person. You get his thoughts, his process, and all that, but then you have to put the third person in when the antagonist is running around, or if it's Jennifer or Knuckles, or those guys are always in third person. And... I didn't know that was some kind of rule I wasn't supposed to do. I just liked the way it read.
But, you know, I think all the best writers break the rules. You know, the only rules, I think, in writing are there are no rules. Don't follow the rules.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. If someone had told me that was a rule, I wouldn't have done it.
Well,
luckily, I didn't read anything about saying it was a rule.
So, I mean, with everything happening in the world, you're not going to run out of material. What's next for you? You said you're already writing your next book.
Yeah, we just came back from Taiwan and Australia, and it's going to have a Chinese bent with artificial intelligence and deep fakes and that kind of stuff. So I'm working on it right now.
Very interesting. And I'm wondering if you have a favorite author, somebody who's influenced you. I know you've mentioned a couple of them.
I actually, it would be hard for me to mention who has influenced me because I've read so much. I've gone through... every phase there is. I went through, you know, a Ray Bradbury phase. I've gone through a fantasy phase with Piers Anthony and J.R.R. Tolkien and all that. And I've read every Stephen King, and they've all influenced me in one way or the other. But I guess the one genre that probably has influenced me the most are murder mysteries, because that's what I read. I don't even read my own genre. So I read John Sanford, Robert Crace, kind of guys to see. And they're the kind of guys, you know, everybody has, if a new book comes out, I don't even read the back, I'll just buy it.
Me too. I love John Sanford, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be Sanford, you know, Virgil Flowers, or, you know, whichever one he's writing at the time, and Robert Craig, same way, I'll buy his.
Yeah. Well, one of the most difficult things, I think, that with any creative process, whether you're creating music or art, is knowing when it is finished. How do you get that feeling? How does that happen for you?
Funny you should ask that, because Hunter Killer was the hardest book I've ever finished. You culminate with the action, but there's still a lack of taste in the mouth, so to speak, where I haven't finished this book. That's finished, but I need to finish this. And I spent more time on the last chapter of the book than the first, the 200 pages preceding that last chapter. The last chapter, I think, is only 5 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just as a reader, I keep reading it until I'm like, okay, that works.
Mm. So I'm looking forward to reading the next book that's coming out. I am now a fan. This is the first of yours that I've read. So I really appreciate you being with us today, Brad. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Yeah, I guess if they wanted to get a taste of the books, they can go to bradtaylorbooks.com. I have excerpts of every one of the novels are on the webpage.
Okay, great. And bradtaylorbooks.com, again, is the website. You can find us at conversationslive.net. Until next week, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.